is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, no end to the migrant crisis in Europe and still no solutions. Hillary Clinton email controversy grows. Part-time scientists compete to put rover on the moon.
Using technology which is kind of not intended to send something to the moon is always very risky. So we have to really slim down everything so that it fits into this less than 4 tons payload vehicle.
A country music pair could have another hit. These and other stories just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. The International Organization for Migration says that more than 350,000 migrants have made the perilous journey across the Mediterranean this year, fleeing turmoil and poverty in the Middle East and Africa in search of a better life in Europe. According to the Intergovernmental Agency, more than 234,000 of them landed on the shores of Greece, with another 114,000 arriving in Italy and much smaller numbers in Spain and Malta. About 2,600 migrants didn't make it. They died, often drowning when rickety, overcrowded boats operated by human traffickers have sunk. The latest figures come as Europe continues to cope with one of its biggest stream of migrants since World War II. The story was the focus of the latest hashtag VOA program. Host Cal Perry spoke with International Edition's Jim Stevenson about some perspectives to better help understand the migrant crisis.
You know, we got lucky. We were interviewing somebody from Serbia, and when they brought up the live shot, there was a young man from Afghanistan who our guest had met in a coffee shop, and he had just spent 2 months traveling all the way from Afghanistan to Serbia and went through this horrific tale of at times spending, you know, 10 hours on the open water. He said he was turned back from the Turkish border 6 separate times. So in all, it took him 2 full months to get to Serbia.
An astounding story. And you were speaking with people who have been working directly with this situation on the front lines in various capacities.
Yeah, in particular the International Committee of the Red Cross, as well as the Refugee Committee from the UN, High Refugee, UNHCR, excuse me. And we spoke to one in particular official in Greece who was saying the optics have become very strange. It's high tourism season in Greece, so you have these ferry boats that are taking tourists from island to island and these beautiful restaurants, these beautiful cafes. And in the same body of water, you have migrants desperately trying to scratch their way onto these ferry boats. So the scene in Greece is become surreal, as it has in many European countries.
An eye-opener for a lot of tourists, I'm sure, who didn't expect to see that or come in such close contact to that.
Yeah, and so many don't know what to do and how to react. The International Red Cross has told us they're seeing individual extraordinary efforts playing out. And at the same time, then, of course, you have at these borders just a mass of humanity waiting to cross.
What are some of the other efforts being waged to help the migrants?
You know, one of the key efforts that we're hearing about is the social media effort, a way to give social media tools to the refugees who are passing through Europe. So in order to find basic needs, in order to find basic housing, where are the places that people are handing out, you know, be it food, water, or shelter, a place where they can meet and organize, for example. I mean, so many of these refugees just don't know where to turn when they arrive in these countries. So perhaps arming them with social media, giving them information, that seems to be a big push.
Hashtag VOA host Cal Perry speaking with International Edition's Jim Stevenson. As Cal was mentioning, one of the people he spoke to was an aid worker in Greece with the International Rescue Committee. The ICRC is a New York-based global humanitarian relief organization. Its field director, Kirk Day, is in the port of Mytilene on the Greek island of Lesbos, where he said authorities there are facing a perfect storm with the migrant and refugee influx.
We're having record numbers of arrivals every day. For most of the summer, we were having 1,000 people arrive a day, two-thirds of which passed through Lesbos. For the past 2 weeks, we've had between 2,000 and 3,000 a day arriving on Lesbos only. And on Saturday, we estimate that the number was probably in excess of 4,000. This in and of itself would put a tremendous strain on what is a compromised relief effort, to say the least. But making matters worse, is that this is the height of tourist season. And so the ferries that the refugees are desperate to catch in order to go to mainland Greece and continue their journey to Europe proper are filled with tourists. So refugees have not been able to catch ferries. There have been a few extraordinary ferries laid on by authorities, but they haven't been sufficient. So we have a backlog of 10 to 15,000 refugees in and around the port of Mytilene, sleeping rough without access to clean water, toilets, and other aid assistance, and sleeping without suitable shelter in alleyways, sidewalks, and the colonnade around the port, in parks, and anywhere they can find free space. And we are worried that frustrations and tensions are running high, and that this is a worrying trend, to say the least.
Yeah, not to put too fine a point on it, the optics of this sound horrible. What happens when people grow overly frustrated with people vacationing while people are dying?
You know, I have to say that it's been amazingly calm to date. But already you're seeing arguments and turning into fights in the port area. And you see local officials, port police, and other police probably beyond their means and expertise to control crowds of this size.
That was Kirk Day of the International Rescue Committee speaking with hashtag VOA's Cal Perry. The show lives on social media. Check out the hashtag VOA Facebook page and follow on Twitter at hashtag VOA. Time to check out what's trending on social media elsewhere. International Edition's G. Abby Lee is here to tell us about tweeting on the migrant crisis.
Hi, Ray. Let's begin with the official Twitter account of the International Organization for Migration. It's on Twitter at IOM_news. Ray, like I mentioned Monday, IOM has been quite active on Twitter recently, and for a good reason. Its new pinned tweet is from Tuesday. It says, "Flash update, latest arrivals and fatalities in the Mediterranean on September 1st. The tweet has an infographic attached, a map of the affected areas with the number of arrivals and fatalities written above the respective countries. And as you know, the country with the biggest number of migrants and their fatalities is Greece.
What about the general public response? What are they saying now?
Ray, one tweet that's getting a lot of attention is a retweet about a poet's explanation of what drives a migrant to begin the perilous journey. It's about a quote by Warsan Shire, a Somali-British poet. She apparently wrote, "No one puts their children in a boat unless the water is safer than the land." Shire herself is a child of migrant parents. She was born to Somali parents in Kenya, and then the family migrated to England.
That's pretty emotional stuff. What about some hashtags people can use to search for tweets related to the current situation?
Well, there are mainly two. Hashtag refugee crisis was used in nearly 2,600 tweets in the last 24 hours. Hashtag migrant crisis was used less than that, with about 2,000 tweets using that hashtag in the same time frame. These figures are, of course, from the Topsy Analytics website. Ray?
Social media reporter G. Abby Lee. You can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. That's JEEABBEYLEE. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. The U.S. State Department has released another 7,000 pages of Democratic presidential contender Hillary Clinton's emails sent and received when she was Secretary of State. Mrs. Clinton authorized the State Department to make 55,000 pages of emails in her private account public. Mrs. Clinton denies doing anything wrong and says it was more convenient to use one email account and one device when she was Secretary of State. State Department spokesman Mark Toner said that about 150 of the Clinton emails have been remarked as classified, but so far it appears that none of the emails was marked as classified or top secret at the time Mrs. Clinton sent or received them. International Edition's Jeffrey Young has more.
Ms. Clinton, who continues to say that she did nothing wrong, is being countered by others who say that not having all of her emails on a government server where they are accountable and able to be preserved for later examination is not only a violation of protocol, but it may allow her to conceal certain sensitive communications. One person raising questions is Mark Rome, a professor at Georgetown University's McCord School of Public Policy.
One of the first things that I would teach someone who's going to work for the government is that you use government servers and government email addresses for governmental work, and a private server and private email addresses for your personal work. This is a basic distinction that any intern working for the government should know, and certainly should be knowledge that we would expect the Secretary of State to both know and abide by.
The State Department said that out of the emails that were released, only 150 of them were subsequently reclassified. A lot of people in the opposition have been looking for the smoking gun against Hillary Clinton, trying to see if she concealed communications. What can you reflect on this?
You know, no matter how many emails were sent and you try to count up and is it classified, is it not classified, how many were classified after the fact and so forth, that's kind of beyond the point, because then we're getting into the specific details rather than the more general principle of if you're working for the government, use government servers. If you're working on behalf of your own interests, use private ones. We can try to count the specific number of emails that had classified information, but that strikes me as less important than the general principle was that Secretary Clinton was using a private server for governmental work. So the exact number is not important. The principle was that she was using a personal server, that is important. And the public should know about that, and the public should care about it.
Benghazi, Benghazi, Benghazi has been brought up so many times. There are people out there looking to see if she could have used her private email account so that she could bypass official accountability, not only for Benghazi, but for other incidents. Do you think there's any traction to that sort of accusation?
Well, it does make you wonder. You know, if she's using a personal server, does that mean that she has something to hide? You know, it may be impossible to answer that question. Perhaps she was not. Perhaps she was. But that's why you don't use a personal server. Doing so inevitably will raise those questions.
That was Dr. Mark Rom, professor at the McCord School of Public Policy at Georgetown University in Washington, speaking with International Edition's Jeffrey Young. In Thailand, a suspect was arrested who matches a description of the bomber at a Bangkok shrine. The August 17th explosion killed 20 people and injured more than 100 others, many of them Asian tourists. VOA correspondent Steve Herman was among the first to report on the explosion. He shares details with International Edition colleague Sarah Williams.
What authorities are telling reporters is that a suspect was arrested at a village called Pa Rai, and that's right on the border with Cambodia. And this occurred around 11 a.m., and he was spotted by a task force of police officers and troops, which had been dispatched to that area to look for suspects who might be trying to flee Thailand, who were connected to this bombing.
Is the citizenship of this suspect known?
No, it is not, and authorities are being mum on that. Now, a number of television channels here in Thailand, shortly after this suspect's arrest, have circulated images of a Chinese passport. We do not know the authenticity of it. The picture, we can say, does look similar to what we've seen, photographs of the man who was arrested. The name in that passport is Yusufu Mayor Riley. a 25-year-old who was born in Xinjiang in China.
And that, of course, has been a place where there has been quite a bit of unrest involving the Uyghur movement.
Right. And there has been speculation because of warrants out for other suspects that there may be some connection between the bombing at the shrine where there were a lot of Chinese tourists and Uyghurs or their sympathizers in Turkey. Authorities came out and named a new suspect as being a citizen of Turkey. And until now, they have been bending over backwards, essentially, not to mention Turkey, not to mention Chinese as possible targets of the shrine bombing. But after Saturday, when we had a 28-year-old man who was arrested, his nationality has still not been disclosed. But he was found with a stack of counterfeit Turkish passports. And there was also a counterfeit Turkish passport with his photograph in it as well.
Are Thai authorities continuing to hunt for other suspects?
Yes, we had three more arrest warrants issued with a photograph for one who is listed as a Turkish male and sketches of two other, presumably, of foreign men as well. And they say that there are other suspects that they're looking for. And they're also asking owners of residences, guest houses, and apartments to inform the nearest military or police officers about any, quote, suspicious individuals that they would happen to see on their premises.
VOA's Steve Herman in Bangkok speaking with International Edition's Sarah Williams. President Obama is in the midst of a three-day visit to Alaska. He's using its scenic but fragile landscape as a backdrop to call attention to a doomsday scenario caused by rising temperatures that could leave entire nations and major coastal cities underwater. Diminishing Arctic sea ice is also intensifying U.S. focus, not only on concerns about global warming, security, and energy, but also on issues of shipping, mineral exploration, and fishing. A new geopolitical great game is underway in the Arctic, where Russia claims a large area for resource development, and President Obama recently approved Shell Oil Company's test drilling project in an area under U.S. control. As VOA's Greg Flakes reports, energy is a big part, but not the only part of the North Pole Prize.
Rice University professor Bill Arnold just returned from his latest fishing trip to Alaska, where he captured photos of unspoiled nature.
There's no other place that I've ever been that's like this. So I'm very interested in the preservation of the beauty of Alaska.
But as a former Shell oil executive, he believes new energy resources can be developed without harming nature. Unlike environmentalists who denounce U.S. oil company projects in the Arctic and express disappointment in the Obama decision. The opening of the Arctic results from ice being melted by global warming, which scientists conclude is caused in large part by emissions from burning fossil fuels, like oil, which the Arctic holds in abundance.
Probably something like 25% of the undiscovered oil and gas in the world is in the Arctic.
Russia, whose territory borders about half of the Arctic, sees the polar region as vital for its own energy production.
I think their view is that as the traditional resources are dwindling, they need to find new resources, and some of the greatest resources in the world are in that area.
But Bill Arnold says the opening of the Arctic has other strategic aspects. He says Russia has a substantial military presence in the region, unlike the United States, which has a much smaller Arctic exposure. As for U.S. energy production, Arnold says it will likely be 7 to 10 years before Shell's exploratory efforts begin to pay off with large-scale production. Greg Flakes, VOA News, Houston.
Coming up, another race to the moon. This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
A new aspartame-free version of Diet Pepsi has arrived on supermarket shelves. Pepsi has replaced aspartame in the popular soda drink with sucralose, the same non-nutritive sweetener found in Splenda. There are many options when it comes to artificial sweeteners. Sweeten Low, or granulated saccharin, was first introduced in 1957. More recently, plant-based sweeteners such as stevia and truvia have gained favor. People like Christine Arundel turned to sugar substitutes to avoid calories.
It is a personal choice of not drinking my calories, but rather wanting to eat them instead of putting them in my drink.
But do sugar substitutes help you lose weight? Dr. Mark Hyman with the Cleveland Clinic.
When you consume artificial sweeteners, they trick your body to think sugar's on the way, and that gears your body up to store the food, and it creates insulin that leads to fat storage.
I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
This is VOA's International Edition coming to you from Washington. 16 teams from around the world are setting their sights on the moon and the $30 million Google Lunar X Prize. The challenge, issued in 2007, is to land a privately funded rover on the lunar surface, travel 500 meters, and transmit back high-definition video and images, all at a fraction of what a typical NASA mission costs. Faith Lapid has caught up with a German team who call themselves the part-time scientists.
With an adjustable solar panel, three cameras, and four sturdy tires, the part-time scientist rover looks ready for action. The team has been at work on the rover since 2008, says founder Robert Berma, using components originally designed for earthbound electronics and for satellites.
Using technology which is kind of not intended to send something to the moon is always very risky. So we have to really slim down everything so that it fits into this less than 4 tons payload vehicle.
Cost is a concern as well, which is one reason the team is making its rover as high-tech as possible.
So what we want to try to do is make as much as high-tech as you would call it available for space applications so that you have like more processing power for less energy, which energy is your number one constraint in space. So, and that really cuts down into our mission costs.
Berma expects their mission cost will be under $30 million. He hopes to secure a contract for a launch vehicle by the end of the year and send the rover on its way by the end of 2017. The 15 other teams in the competition are from Brazil, Canada, Chile, Hungary, Japan, Israel, Italy, Malaysia, India, and the United States. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Country singers Maddie Marlowe and Tay Dye burst onto the scene last year with a song that poked fun at the male-dominated lyrics on country radio. Now their first CD called Start Here is out, and their second single is climbing the country airplay charts. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with Country Hits USA host Nikki Strong about Maddie and Tay and their rise to stardom.
You might not know what bro country is, but Maddie and Tay do, and their first single that went to number one was all about bro country. Nikki, explain to the listeners, first of all, what bro country is and why the song The Girl in a Country Song was such a big hit.
Well, bro country is male-dominated country music where men are centered, and it's all about the guys and what the guys do, what makes the guys bond. It's male-centered country music.
And, you know, it's women tend to be more ornamental to the men in
the
character.
Yes,
so
yes,
Maddie and Tay got a little tired of that.
They did. What was really hilarious is that they were going to a recording session and they were listening to country radio and they started making a checklist. They realized the lyrics were similar and they were like, wait a second. They found that there were a lot of cliches. So they wrote them down. They were like, okay, bare feet, cutoffs, tan lines, tan legs, and definitely a girl. And this smoking hot girl is usually in cutoff jeans with long tan legs and she's dancing on a tailgate, shaking her moneymaker. And they were like, wow.
Moneymaker being a name for her
derriere,
her rear end.
Exactly. And they thought it would be fun to give this girl a voice in a song. And that's where Girl in a Country Song came into play.
Good for you.
went to number one in December of last year.
That's
surprise,
right.
Surprise. And some of the guys, Jason Aldean and Luke Bryan and Blake Shelton and Florida Georgia Line, and all these other guys that had been making bro country had to kind of answer to that.
Yes. You know, what's interesting is that Florida Georgia Line, I think it was Bryan, who said, I don't know any girl who wouldn't want to be a girl in a country song, which I thought spoke a lot to the disconnect, the dehumanization of the woman and of the girl. And so I thought it was interesting that his response was very much like, oh.
And see, now, that was so popular, and you're only as good as your last record.
Yes.
And so Maddie and Tay had to come up with a second single.
Yes, yes.
Which Tay Dye, that's her full name, has said, you know, we were trying to write this thing that would be like a girl in country song as part two.
Right, the pressure.
And they ended up coming up with a very different sounding tune called Fly.
Yes, about really, which is about perseverance through adversity. And I think when they talked about trying to write another hit and that pressure of following up, and they just threw it out and said, you know what, let's just be honest and let's write something from our hearts and let's write something that's true to us. And that's how Fly came about as well.
All right. Well, you know, if you want to send a tweet to Nikki, you can send one to @VOA_music. You can also listen for Nikki when she hosts Country Hits USA. You can find that on our website, www.voanews.com.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. You can find more news, information, and videos on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Modern slavery is a blight on humanity and is nearly universally condemned, but it does not exist in a vacuum. Trafficking in persons is often perpetrated by well-organized transnational criminal gangs that ensure smooth operations through bribery. In the process, they destroy not only the lives of people whom they enslave, they degrade entire economies. Slavery doesn't just destroy communities and harm everyday people. It fuels a network of ruthless criminals and armed groups that create insecurity and instability around the world, said David Luna, a senior director in the Office of Anti-Crime Programs at the U.S. State Department's Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs. The societal harms and impacts posed by human trafficking are very real. Corruption helps to fuel it and enriches not only those criminal networks behind today's modern slavery, but also enables corrupt police, customs, judicial, and other security officials who protect traffickers and allow them to carry out their criminal activities. Modern slavery recognizes no borders, and therefore, just as no economy is immune from corruption, no single jurisdiction can solve this problem on its own. To defeat this scourge, the community of nations must begin by making clear to the public how much harm human trafficking causes to communities and educating vulnerable populations about the methods used to ensnare and exploit those they enslave. We must also increase the scrutiny of supply chains where little to none may exist. Governments must adopt the highest standards of accountability and human rights protection and ensure that their suppliers and contractors are held to those standards as well. At the same time, international organizations and companies must enforce policies against human trafficking throughout their supply chains. Mechanisms must be established to report cases of abuse, harassment, or violence, and to identify and protect victims of trafficking. Human trafficking siphons away the human capital potential of communities to build sustainable economic growth in a manner that respects human rights, said Mr. Luna. No person should ever have a price tag attached to their heart and soul, nor be restricted, abused, and violated against their physical integrity and free will.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.